safe. He's safe.
He's kidnapped, Derek corrected her, which is not very safe.
But it's alive, said Olivia.
We're going to ask you not to discuss this with anyone, said Finelli. Not your parents, not your teachers, not your friends, not a single classmate. It won't be easy. We'll have to think up excuses for this time we've spent.
Does Dr. Larkin know? Asked Derek. Does Mr. Lynch?
They do not. We will instruct Dr. Larkin not to ask you anything. Now promise you're going to keep this situation secret. The most important thing is not to throw New York City into a panic. We cannot use the word smallpox.
The most important thing to me, said Olivia, is finding Mitty.
We'll find him. Derek wasn't so sure.
He wasn't all that impressed by the FBI's track record. What had it taken? 10 or 15 years to locate the Unabomber? And even then it wasn't the FBI who'd found him. The guy's brother had figured it out, and nobody had solved the anthrax mailing.
To explain this meeting, Finelli suggested, tell your friends that there was some initial confusion about Mitty's whereabouts, and Dr. Larkin thought you might have information, but in fact Mitty's parents took him out of school early for vacation. This was almost reasonable, because winter vacation was only 2 weeks off. St. Ray parents had little use for school calendars and pretty much took trips when they felt like it. Olivia and Derek were dismissed. They left the headmaster's office and walked through the tangle of secretaries' desks and out into the main hall, where they ground to a halt like stalled cars. They had so many more questions, so much talking to do. Dr. Larkin rushed out to them.
Now go straight back to class, he said briskly.
Of course, said Olivia.
I'll meet with you later, said Dr. Larkin.
Absolutely, said Derek.
Dr. Larkin went back to his office. Olivia and Derek went out the front door. They stood on the granite steps, staring at a sky that also looked granite.
I can't believe that man seriously thought you and I would sit in a classroom at a time like this, said Olivia.
Let's go over to Mitty's apartment, said Derek. See what his parents know.
You think they'll talk to us? She said doubtfully.
Mitty's best friend and his girlfriend? Of course they'll talk to us. They must be scared to death, hanging over their phone, trying to call Mitty on his cell, praying he'll call them, reading his biology paper and that horrible letter over and over.
I don't think Mr. and Mrs. Blake even know I exist.
Probably not, agreed Derek. If I had a girlfriend, I wouldn't talk it over with my mom and dad. But they know now, because they must have talked to these guys.
It was only a dozen short blocks to Mitty's, making the subway more trouble than it was worth. Olivia was usually a big window shopper and loved looking in every window, from the locksmith with his 4-foot-wide shop, to the shoe store she couldn't afford, from the boutiques that specialized in brimless caps or glitzy evening bags, to the bakery windows, where she took one look and had to have that pastry or collapse. Now she couldn't see through her tears.
Let's not take Columbus Avenue, she said to Derek. Let's walk along the river.
He's not in the river, Olivia. If the NYPD or the FBI thought Mitty drowned himself, they'd be out there.
But they turned west anyway.
East-west blocks were long, and today they seemed even longer. At the sight of the Hudson, Olivia burst into tears.
Why didn't Mitty trust me? Why didn't he share any of this with me?
He didn't trust me either, and I'm not crying, said Derek. Cut it out with the emotion. We have to think what to do next.
Derek would stack his brains against anybody's, and Olivia's brains were way better than his. The two of them could get ahead of any old FBI in a New York minute.
If Mitty could communicate with us, he would, said Olivia. His silence is a bad sign.
Derek wasn't convinced that Mitty wanted to do any communicating. If Mitty had gone underground, he could only pull it off by not communicating. The problem with vanishing in New York was, where did you find the privacy and the money to pay for it? Transportation was a problem. Sure, there were a million trains and buses, but to where? And what then?
Stop trying to see a body in the Hudson, Olivia. We need to figure out where Mitty would hide out.
You think that's what happened?
I would hide out. It would be more fun that way. Well, fun if you don't get smallpox. Mitty gets smallpox, and I guess he's pretty much permanently out of fun.
Olivia sat down on a bench. There were dozens of them facing the Hudson, lined up against gnarled cherry trees. In spring, summer, and fall, Riverside Park was a joy. In February, it had nothing going for it. Derek sat down next to her.
I'm not going to school tomorrow either, Olivia told him. I don't want anybody questioning me. I don't want to risk sobbing with anybody but you. I don't want to do something stupid like take a quiz. I just want to sit on this bench.
And freeze to death and think about MIDI?
No, we'll think of something to do. We'll accomplish something.
Olivia took out her cell phone and called the school. Olivia? Said Dr. Larkin excitedly, as if he had known all along that she would tell him everything.
Derek and I will not be in class for the remainder of the week.
Olivia, I don't know what's going on, but you leave whatever it is to the FBI. You two get back here right now, or I will telephone your parents.
And tell them what?
Asked Olivia,
since we're not permitted to discuss any aspect of this. Derek and I will not fall behind in class. Kindly give us excused absences for the rest of today and for Thursday and Friday.
How surprising, thought Derek, that MIDI had been drawn to this girl. MIDI was relaxed and good-humored, slow to worry and quick to have a good time. Olivia was not relaxed, not particularly good-humored, and had a rare definition of a good time. Scholarship. Olivia hung up.
It was fun to give Dr. Larkin orders, but basically I'm scared, Derek. The men in the office and Dr. Graham, they didn't seem scared. How come they weren't scared?
I think they're just good actors.
But maybe they know more than they said, or they're too excited to be scared.
I was excited following anthrax history. You were excited following typhoid. But this is the real thing. Maybe it's so exciting to be in the midst of bioterrorism that they don't have time to be scared. Now, you're right. We have to think of something to do.
I can't think of anything except to walk up and down every street of the five boroughs looking for a thread for Mitty's sweater, said Olivia glumly.
I bet it's only four boroughs, said Derek. Manhattan's pretty high rent for taking prisoners. They'd want some isolated warehouse in some wreck of a slum where Mitty could scream all he wants and nobody would hear.
They gazed at the water. No bodies. Nobody looking for bodies either.
Derek couldn't stand it. He hauled Olivia on to 72nd Street, where they left the park, past Eleanor Roosevelt's statue, and headed to Mitty's.
It just seems strange, said Olivia, for those guys to tell us everything and risk having us let out the news. Smallpox news.
It's all about risk, thought Derek. You're always guessing. A little knowledge here, a speck of information there. You do the best you can with what you have. And what does Mitty have right now?
Anything?
Mrs. Blake was barely holding together. She struggled to have a normal conversation with these friends of her missing son.
I wish I'd known Mitty was dating such a lovely girl,
she said, trying to smile.
It's a stretch to say we're dating, Olivia said honestly. I was pushing for it, but Mitty's mind was elsewhere.
Mrs. Blake started weeping, which from the look of her face she'd been doing a lot of.
His mind was on death and disease. I had no idea Mitty was keeping secrets from me.
Derek was pretty sure every 16-year-old boy in the world kept secrets from his mother, but for Mitty's sake he was nicer than he would have been to his own mother. Not secrets, Mrs. Blake, just stuff he hadn't worked through yet. The whole letter is somebody still thinking it through. He saw that she did not agree, that she had found the letter pretty coherent. She looked away from Derek and into the eyes of this girl her son liked.
Do you think Mitty killed himself?
No,
said Olivia calmly. Derek gave Olivia points. He told Mrs. Blake about Mitty's teen suicide essay. Mr. Blake was just standing there. Derek didn't want to look at Mitty's father. He was afraid that while Mitty's mother was still hoping, Mitty's father had assumed the worst. Mrs. Blake pressed her hands over her mouth and then took them away, and words she did not want to speak flew out of her mouth.
What do you think of the FBI's theory about, you know, some sort of people taking Mitty?
She was dancing around the word terrorists.
What if he's out there somewhere, the prisoner of somebody planning to harvest smallpox virus from his body?
Harvest? Repeated Derek.
That's the word the CDC used, as if it's a crop. As if Mitty is a field, and when he breaks out in pustules...
Derek changed the subject. Did you guys know about these scabs? He asked Mr. Blake. No. They searched his room, but although Mitty had four old books listed in his bibliography, there were only three under his bed. No envelope. His backpack is gone, though. Maybe he has that book and the scabs with him.
Can we look around? Asked Derek.
Sure, but the FBI was thorough. Mr. Blake led them into Mitty's bedroom. Olivia stood in the door of Mitty's room, appalled. She didn't even want to go in. People lived like this? People she liked lived like this?
What exactly happened? You called the NYPD, and then they called the FBI and the CDC? Asked Derek.
As far as we can tell, Mitty's emails were forwarded to the FBI and to the CDC. Both of them were closing in on his location at the same time we were calling the police. The CDC got here in the middle of the night, hoping to find the scabs. The FBI dusted for fingerprints as if Mitty could have been snatched from here.
Derek doubted that.
What with doormen and desk staff, it would be hard for strangers to get into the building unnoticed. And if they did slip in, and knew the right apartment, and got up to the 8th floor, and Mitty let them in, and they overpowered him, how did they get him back down in a small elevator used by 26 floors worth of residents, without somebody noticing an unconscious or fighting teenage boy? They went back to the splendid living room, with its fine paintings and large furniture. Floor-to-ceiling windows looked down on a school playground and the thin, sad boughs of small trees in winter. Behind these were apartment buildings, narrow and tall like a child's drawing of a cityscape. Olivia said, "Does Mitty's sister know?"
"We called Emily at college," said Mrs. Blake. "Her plane is due in another hour. We can't leave the phone in case Mitty calls. My brother is picking her up."
If Mitty called, he could use their cell numbers. They didn't have to stay in the same room with their regular line. But maybe if the Blakes weren't safely inside this apartment, their fear would spin out of control. And there was a lot to be scared about. Because kidnappers would want Mitty dead in the end, Derek thought, since he could identify them. So even if Mitty hadn't already died of smallpox, or drowning, or anything else, he was still going to be dead. Mitty's father must have arrived at this conclusion before Derek and was keeping silent because he knew there was no good ending. Mrs. Blake and Olivia were filled with hope and the conviction that all would be well. There's no way, thought Derek. Chapter 15. Faintly, through the hole where the TV cable had been strung, Mitty heard a radio. He chinned himself on a black iron pipe to listen. The dial was tuned to 10-10 winds. The camp bed was not sturdy enough or high enough for Mitty to stand on, and there was no handy stool to drag over, so when the ads came on, he let go of the pipe and rested, and when the news came on, he chinned up again. Eventually, he had heard traffic, weather, sports, and headlines. 24 hours since anybody had heard from him, and yet Mitty Blake was not a headline. How could that be? His mother went ballistic when he missed 1 hour of school. She was not going to take an overnight disappearance lightly. By now, she would have phoned everybody she'd ever met, and his sister, Emily, would be on her way home from college. Mrs. Blake would want not just the NYPD on this, but also the FBI, the CIA, and Superman. In ordinary circumstances, the police would probably refuse to get involved. 16-year-olds run away and do stupid things, and there you have it. But by now, somebody somewhere ought to be looking for Mitty. But no one was. Mitty felt his way around in the dark, touching every wall, jumping up to touch every support beam, sliding his fingers down electrical wires and plumbing connections, running his hands along the bottoms of rafters. Mainly, he got splinters. Finally, he located a nail so lightly tapped into the wood that he was able to pull it out with his fingers. It was not much of a nail, long and thin, barely strong enough to hang a calendar on. My weapon, thought Mitty. Then he taught himself to find the light bulb from anywhere in the cellar by counting off paces. At some point, they stopped listening to the radio upstairs. Bad enough he was down here in the dark with a nail instead of a chainsaw. Now he'd lost his only friend, the constant cheery repetition of the same old news. If he lived through this, he was definitely planning to patronize all the Wynn's advertisers. The only people right now who cared about him and wanted him alive. Right over his head, a cell phone rang. Its programmed ring was "Here Comes the Bride." Mitty had already assumed these guys weren't American. Like when those planes crashed into the World Trade Towers, every pilot the TV stations called for opinions said no American pilot would do that. Now he knew his kidnappers couldn't be American. Only a total alien wouldn't recognize that melody. Any American would change it. Maybe the call was from the person in charge, who had to be working on the next stage of the plan. Mitty didn't see how they could manage their operation out of the cellar. He had just decided to go sit on the top step and try to hear the phone conversation through the door when it opened. 14 steps above Mitty stood a man in a red ski mask, jeans, and a plaid wool shirt. Behind him, Mitty could see kitchen cabinets. There was not time for Mitty to take the stairs in a single bound and stick his foot in the door to keep it from locking. The guy tossed a McDonald's bag at Mitty, stepped back, and slammed the door. The cellar was dark again, but Mitty was a total fast food fan. He could figure it out by feel and smell. 2 burgers, large fries, a chocolate shake, and an apple pie. It was like Thanksgiving. Mitty chowed down. When he finished, he was still hungry, so he licked the paper for leftover salt and grease. Then he folded the bag neatly and set it on the end of his camp bed, saving the napkin and the empty flattened fry and pie boxes. His tool collection. He was afraid he'd lose the nail if he set it down, so he didn't add that to the pile, but slid it carefully into his jeans pocket. The food took care of the pain in his gut. Now all he had was the hole in his cheek and the throbbing in his skull. And fear. He had lots of that. Mitty knew now that he'd spent his life paddling in a clear pond, happy and dumb as a duck. Now, suddenly, the water was deep and murky. Slime had him by the ankles. For the first time in his life, music was a barrier to thought. He put away the iPod. How miraculous that nobody in America had the slightest idea what smallpox was like. Not one of the 290 million. But smallpox was exactly what his sources said. The number one biological warfare agent. The stumbling block in bioterrorism is that some scientist in some laboratory has to sneak the disease out. Who would risk his own life, his family's lives, his colleagues, in fact, the lives of everyone in his whole country? Even if that scientist hated America with all his heart and mind and soul, that hate would be the opposite of some love, wouldn't it? Love for his country or people or religion. And he would not risk his own life, would he? And so bioterrorism would always be a threat, but it would never be acted upon. Until he, Mitty Blake, allowed terrorists to skip a step. He personally was providing the virus, and in a central location, too. The only risk was to Americans, and that was the point of terrorism, putting Americans at risk. Mitty had never gone out of his way to gather or to exhibit intelligence. It was time. He was past the stage where he could gather information. All his intelligence had to be guesses, but maybe all intelligence was guesses. How were they planning to use Mitty? Did they hope to create an aerosol and release that somewhere in the city? It seemed pretty high-tech for guys keeping a prisoner in a cellar with a rusty toilet. The only real option for these guys was to use Mitty as the infection agent, just as Derek had described. But even in New York, 2 gowned, masked, and gloved guys pushing a coughing, moaning carcass in a wheelchair through, say, Penn Station were bound to attract attention. And even if the regular passengers averted their eyes, the major train stations were crawling with security. These 2 guys would have to dress normally and just face the fact that they were going to get smallpox too. But no matter what clothes they put on, they weren't normal. People who plotted to commit mass murder were not normal. So, properly dressed, would they duct tape Mitty into a wheelchair and start pushing? They'd want Mitty to breathe and cough, but they wouldn't want him strong enough to yell, because it would really screw up the plan if the human bomb started shouting, "Call 911. They probably had about a 10-minute window where this would work. And then Mitty, flat out with agony and black blisters, would be screaming his head off with pain, and the authorities would come running. Well, that was what happened when you committed your terrorism on the spur of the moment. You had glitches. After all this thinking, Mitty arrived at exactly 2 conclusions. 1, the guys upstairs were not normal. 2, he was in big trouble. Of course, they could be soft-hearted kidnappers. He wouldn't get a rash. He wouldn't get sick. They wouldn't have their virus, and a week from now they'd say, "Too bad," and slip quietly away, leaving the door unlocked so Mitty could head on home. They had another glitch, although they didn't know about it. The hole in the floor where he'd yanked down the cable cord. One book had had a gruesome story about some poor woman in a British lab. Smallpox research was taking place on a different floor from hers. A window cracked for fresh air carried the virus outdoors. The breeze lifted it around the side of the building and up through her open window and into her room. she died. These two men had darted out of the cellar like squirrels from a dog rather than let Mitty touch them again. If they had been vaccinated against smallpox, wouldn't they have stayed to beat him up a little more? So they had no protection except their layers of paper. Plus, if his guesses about the rustling sounds were right, they stripped off their paper covers once they got upstairs. "Should have done your research," Mitty said silently to his captors. "My virus is wafting into your lungs right now." Hours later, Mitty pulled the light bulb chain. After so much time in the dark, 25 watts felt like the sun in July. Mitty did a quick skin examination, and then eased up the stairs with his nail. The bulb was too distant and weak to light up the door. He was still working in the dark. Mitty padded around the handle until he found the keyhole. Time to learn lockpicking. This did not turn out to be a silent activity. The guys upstairs were either sound asleep or out of town, because scratch, poke, twirl, and stab though he might, no one came to stop him. He achieved nothing with his nail. He rammed it hard and it snapped off, filling the keyhole. Mitty sighed. He went back down, pulled the chain again, and stood in the dark. His original plan had been to die prior to getting the disease, so that the disease couldn't exist. How did a person die on purpose when a person had no weapons? Over the long term, a person could stop drinking. If you didn't take in any water, it would be pretty quick, Mitty thought. You couldn't go 48 hours without water, could you? Maybe you could go twice that. He'd be infectious by then. Mitty had no desire to die. He had a million hopes for life. He wanted every minute of his life, and in his family, lives were long. His father's father was still running marathons at 88. Well, entering marathons, at least. That was the kind of gene pool Mitty had. Plus, of course, his relatives all followed longevity rule number one. Don't get smallpox. Rule number two would be, answer the right emails. If only he had more knowledge. If only these guys were talking so he could guess something about them, figure out who they were and what they stood for. If only he could win them over, or entice them into a trap, or guide them into kinder, gentler lifestyles. But far from moving them to a kinder, gentler lifestyle, this little adventure would probably whet their appetites. No doubt they too were having smallpox dreams, but picturing New Yorkers screaming and suffering, scared and dying, as presumably Muhammad Atta and his 18 cohorts had pictured New Yorkers screaming and suffering, scared and dying. It came to Mitty that it didn't matter who these guys were and where they came from. It didn't matter whether Mitty was getting smallpox or not, and it didn't matter whether these two got smallpox either. What mattered was this. If they couldn't use Mitty in biological terrorism, they'd move on. They'd plan and carry out some other type of terrorism. He thought of the magnificent passengers on the flight over Pennsylvania on 9/11. Men and women calling home, getting the terrible news, grasping the full horror of what was happening. They were to be used to bomb the Capitol. And the passengers said no. Nobody is using us as a bomb. We'll take you down first. We'll die, but you won't win. Mitty would follow their example and kill these guys along with himself. The world didn't need them. As Derek had pointed out, though, that wouldn't get rid of the guy in charge, who was safely off in the mountains of wherever. But Mitty couldn't accomplish anything in the mountains of wherever. So he considered what he could accomplish in the basement. Gas, fire, water, electricity. City people did not tend to know much about their basement, and if they lived in a huge apartment building like Mitty's, they had never even been in it, because that was the territory of the maintenance staff. Mitty, however, had a country house, and in that house, over the years, anything that could go wrong had gone wrong. His father had fixed everything at least once. If he had to hire guys to do the work, like when they put in central air, he would drive out to Roxbury constantly to ask questions and be part of it. But whenever possible, he did the work himself on weekends. So Mitty knew more about a basement than your average Manhattan kid. He could break the water pipe so that the water supply could not be turned off. There was no sump pump down here to take water back out. He had no idea how quickly the basement would fill with water, probably hours rather than days, and he didn't have to fill the entire basement. The water just had to enter the electric panel. Once that happened, he was toast. Mitty tried to imagine himself standing quietly in water up to his chest, waiting to be electrocuted. No, he'd be hanging from the rafters by his toenails trying to stay out of the water. He could blow the place up. The furnace would have a safety device that shut off the gas flow if the pilot went out. If Mitty disabled it and then blew the pilot light out himself, gas would keep pouring into the basement. After a while, all Mitty would need was a spark. But for safety reasons, gas had a stinking smell added to it, just so that couldn't happen accidentally. These guys would know what was going on. They'd have plenty of time to drag Mitty out, go into their duct tape routine, throw him in a vehicle and find another place to hunker down. He considered a third possibility. This was the one he had thought of all through the first night, because of course he knew the moment he glanced at the furnace. Mitty Blake prayed. God, what I need here is courage. Don't let me wimp out. I hate wimps. Don't let me get scared. I don't have time. Don't let me screw up. I don't have time for that either. Neither does New York. Chapter 16. Thursday passed. Friday crawled by. Every now and then they threw hamburgers down the stairs. Mitty tried not to leap up and grab the bags, tried not to rip them open, tried not to gulp each burger in two swallows, but he was starving. The heat of the food, the smell, the taste, even the tiny instant of action were relief from the dark, the monotony and the fear. Sometimes Mitty kept the light on and sometimes they turned it off from upstairs. Mostly he slept. The cot sagged even more under his weight. Sometimes he used his folded t-shirt for a very thin pillow, and sometimes he wet it down and used it for an ice pack on his cheek, which was now hot and swollen. His headache had returned, but it was different now. Heaviness at the base of his skull blunted his ability to think. Now and then he heard murmurs upstairs, but he could never distinguish words. Several times he smelled coffee. He tried to plan. After he discarded ridiculous or hopeless or pointless ideas, not much was left. Every plan he came up with required the cooperation of the guys upstairs, and that was a stupid thing to expect. Now and then he chinned himself up to the ceiling to listen to the radio. The Harlem Globetrotters were at Madison Square Garden. The temperature was 38. The World Trade Center PATH station, which had reopened, was once more the busiest stop on the line, with 30,000 riders a day. Still no mention of a missing teenage boy from the Upper West Side. On Friday night, the Blakes would normally drive to the country. Mitty could not begin to imagine how his parents were handling this. There was no way now to retract the letter on the computer, and maybe it was just as well. The letter had become more true than he had anticipated. Every terrorism expert Mitty had read said the next attack on America would be soon, and would be worse. Mitty was the only person who could make sure this particular bunch of terrorists couldn't carry out their plans. He liked to think that for New York he would do anything. But what? What could he actually do? At some point he checked his skin for the last time. Then he sank back into sleep. It was a deep, heavy sleep, as if his body knew this was its last chance. He didn't wake up when the door at the top of the stairs opened. He didn't wake up when somebody walked halfway down. He didn't wake up when that person changed his mind and went back up the stairs, leaving the door open. What woke Mitty later was the smell of hamburgers and fries. But even though he could smell them, he could not drag himself out of sleep. The guard did not throw the bag. He came all the way down the stairs. Slowly, Mitty turned his head. After a while, he opened his eyes. He could sort of see blue paper and the red ski mask, but he couldn't keep his eyes open long enough to know if it was real or a dream. He was cold. He wasn't wearing his t-shirt. He must have hung it up by the furnace to dry. The vinyl of the cot bothered his skin. The guard was carrying a small black cylinder. He'll shoot me, thought Mitty, unable to care. But it was a flashlight. The guard played the light over Mitty's bare chest, arms, and face. Then he stepped back, calling urgently to his partner, who ran down to look. They screamed at each other in the language Mitty did not know, and then the second guy ran back upstairs and rustled into his paper. Mitty knew what they were looking at. Macules. Still flat like freckles at this stage. Little clusters of dots on his chest and arms, thicker on the backs of his hands, and probably thickest where Mitty couldn't see, and where it mattered most, his face. Mitty had seen them last night, standing under the light bulb for his final exam. The men crept closer, hunched down, staring at Mitty as if deciding whether to use wasp spray or rat poison. Then the first guy straightened up. He jabbed his arm and closed his fist at the ceiling as if he held a rifle. "You will die," he said to Mitty. It was the first thing he had said out loud. He had the same accent as the woman in brown. "You will die," he repeated, and now he was laughing. "And then your people will die. We," he told Mitty, "we will dance in the streets." The men went backward up the stairs, as if the virus could not approach people who dared to look it in the eye, and they kicked the cellar door shut. My streets, thought Mitty Blake. My Broadway. My Columbus. My Amsterdam. No. You will not dance in my streets. They had left the bag of hamburgers and fries at the foot of the stairs, directly under the bulb, a dozen feet from Mitty. The smell was nauseating. He didn't want to throw up, but he had to. He thrashed around on the slick polyethylene. He could not accept that he was never going to be comfortable again. After a long time, he dragged himself to a sitting position. His knees formed a handy rest for his head, which was now too heavy to lift. He tried to get up and couldn't. He rested for a while and then slid to his knees and crawled to a lolly column that braced a rafter. He hauled himself upright by the metal post. Walking was harder than he had expected. Even keeping his balance was hard. The journey to the toilet was long. When he got to the toilet, he bent over it, gripped its sides, and began retching. For a few minutes, it was just awful, pointless choking. His back curved over and his gut clenched. And then it happened. He really vomited. The acid burned his throat and mouth. He tried to turn on the faucet, but didn't seem to have the strength. When he finally got a trickle, it hurt to bend, hurt to hold his mouth to it, hurt to swallow. Then he couldn't turn it off. He made it back to the camp bed and gagged again, spitting threads of sour vomit right where he had to lie down. It didn't make any difference now. When he dropped on the camp bed, it finally collapsed from his weight. Mitty let out a cry of despair and went down on his knees next to the ruined bed, bawling himself up, cradling his head with his hands. Mitty Blake was not a shedder of tears. He didn't cry now, either. He just whimpered, like a dog whose paw had been run over. He might have slept then. He might not. He knew only that he begged God to let it happen faster. He couldn't keep this up. But there were no choices for Mitty now. He had to keep this up. After a long time, Mitty heard himself use the last word on earth he ever wanted to use. He hadn't planned it. He didn't want it. He couldn't stop it. "Please," he thought. When he realized they could not hear his thoughts, he summoned all his strength and cried out loud, "Please!" Nothing happened. Eventually, he slept on the floor. The cellar door opened, and he half woke, half remembered where he was and what he was doing. They both came down. Maybe they would nurse him, bring him water. He tried to wet his dry lips, but it didn't happen. He framed the word, but produced no sound. "Water," he begged silently. Mitty was filthy from his running nose, his vomit, and even by this time his urine. The guards jeered at him in their own language, but Mitty fell asleep again. The next time he woke up, 10 seconds later, 10 minutes, maybe even another day, he saw that they had brought a cheap folding guest bed down into the cellar. The metal kind, with the blue, ticking, striped mattress supported on wire links. It was old-fashioned and institutional-looking, as if Typhoid Mary had just stopped using it. It had little wheels, maybe so the corpse could be easily removed from the room. He knew they had not brought a bed to give him comfort. They just didn't want to bend down to the floor when they needed to do something for Mitty. And keeping him alive for whatever time they required would take nursing care. They crossed their arms across their chests. They weren't holding anything, having used their hands to carry the fold to bed. They waited, obviously hoping he would climb into his deathbed on his own. Mitty was willing. He was desperate to rest his head on something soft. But he couldn't move. He wept instead. And this time real tears came, as hot as what must be boiling within him. They got on either side of him, their paper layers scraping against his poor skin. Mitty's body was flaccid and heavy. He fell against the edge of the fold-a-bed, which rolled several feet into the darkness. One guard stepped over to retrieve it, while the second guy tried to steady Mitty. Mitty flung himself sideways with every bit of strength he possessed, and the two of them hit the floor together. Mitty grabbed the guy's head and slammed it down into the cement, rolling away fast to avoid a kick from the other guard. He rolled around the column and leaped to his feet. The second guy's gloved fist caught Mitty in the cheek, splitting open the earlier wound, but Mitty hooked the bed with his foot and rammed it into them, giving himself a barrier and enough time to leap up the stairs. They had left the door open. They always left it open. Mitty scrambled for the door, and they screamed in rage, vaulting on top of him, fingers closed around his ankles. They weren't letting him get out of here. But Mitty didn't want to get out. He yanked the door shut, and automatically it locked. Mitty wiped himself down with his palms, smearing the little dots of coal dust he had so carefully put all over his skin. He looked down at the masks of his captors. "Fooled you, didn't I?" he said, grinning. Chapter 17. They hauled him down the stairs by the feet. His bare chest and wounded cheek whapped against the rough edge of each tread. Then they kicked him aside so they could attack the door. The kick caught Mitty in the jaw, right where he had already taken two blows. One of the guys began hitting the door, swearing at it in English. It wouldn't be hard to pull these two over the edge and make this a real fight. But Mitty still had things to do, places to go, people to see. He put the furnace between himself and them. Suddenly, one guy calmed down. He laughed. He lifted his paper packaging, reached into his pants pocket, and took out a heavy, jangling ring of keys. He held it up for Mitty to see. Mitty hardly noticed. He was fighting nausea. He had not expected that. He had faked being sick. He had planned for two long, empty, boring days and nights exactly what it would take to convince the guys upstairs that they needed to be down here with him. He had gone on and on, displaying one lousy symptom after another, until he thought he would be a lunatic before those two guys took any action. To keep up his act, he had told himself lies, hour after hour. And now he didn't know if it had been an act. Had he forced himself to retch and whimper and moan? Or had it been happening anyway? Had he been kidding himself that he was faking it for a higher cause? If he were to rest his head on his knees right now, he would never lift it again. "Because my jaw's broken," he said to himself, "not because I have smallpox." He did not know why this mattered to him under the circumstances. At the top of the stairs, they were getting nowhere with their key. Their bodies blocked any ray of light given off by the bulb. Now they were probably yelling at each other because neither of them had brought the flashlight. The keychain guy came back down the stairs, held his keys up to the light bulb, carefully picked out the right key, and went back to try again. No go. He yelled at the keys, yelled at the lock, yelled at his friend. Then he tried every key. "Give it up," thought Mitty. "I jammed the keyway with a nail." His jaw was exploding with pain. He spit a tooth into his hand. So much for all that orthodonture. They stared down at him, motionless in their blue paper clothes and their red masks, and then "Here Comes the Bride" rang out. Mitty had assumed that the clunking sounds that preceded their every move upstairs were the emptying of pockets, the key ring, the cell phone, the whatever. He'd been wrong. They had their keys, and they had their phone. Now they'd just summoned backup. But the phone rang on while the men pounded on the door. They had indeed left it in the kitchen. Unfortunately, not answering the phone would also bring assistance. Whoever was calling must want to know how things were going. When they didn't get an answer, they'd try again, and then a third time, and then they'd get in their car and come investigate. "I have no hope," thought Mitty. "My plan won't work." He retreated to a corner of the cellar where they could not quite see him from their post at the top of the stairs. They descended a few steps so they could keep their eyes on him. "I do have smallpox," he told them quietly. "I faked the spots with coal dust, but the rest is real. This is day 14, and I'm infectious, and no paper shirt is going to keep Variola Major from its work. You're dead men." He made his way to the faucet. He swirled cold water around his mouth and spit out the blood. Then he drank. He wished he'd paid attention in history and English. If he had actually read his Shakespeare or Homer, if he actually knew the battles of the Revolutionary War or the World Wars, he could tell himself those stories and pretend that he was about to die a warrior's death. But he wasn't. The guards sat down, one on the second step from the bottom, and the other several steps higher. Mitty was used to their ski masks now. He was glad he would never see their faces. It made things easier. He did not sit near the water supply, because eventually these two would want access to it. He needed his own corner of this very small space. He headed for the furnace. He did not look at his goal. This was like basketball. You kept your eye on the person guarding you, not the person to whom you were going to pass. He was very close to his captors now. The stair rail was between them. But this was a visual barrier, not a real blockade. He took another step. The men did not seem to sense anything coming. Mitty reached up fast and clapped his hands like cymbals, smashing the single light bulb between his palms. Splinters of glass sliced his palms, meaningless compared to the pain in his jaw. In the dark, Mitty moved fast. These guys knew where they were on the stairs, but they wouldn't be able to find their way in the dark. They shouted pointlessly while Mitty slipped behind the furnace and grabbed the t-shirt he had put there. This was a gas furnace, and Mitty knew that when gas combines with oxygen, it burns cleanly and produces colorless, odorless, tasteless carbon dioxide, which goes out a metal pipe and up the chimney. If the chimney is blocked, though, the waste gas does not leave the cellar, but instead begins to fill the space left by the burned oxygen. Eventually, the proportion of oxygen to gas changes. From then on, as the gas burns, the result is colorless, odorless, tasteless, and very poisonous carbon monoxide. The furnace in this old cellar was also old. Nobody had been maintaining it. Mitty considered the possibility that he felt this lousy because the flu was in bad shape already, and he'd been breathing a low level of carbon monoxide for 4 days. But in the end, it didn't matter, because this was the end. Ignoring the glass splinters in his hand, Mitty felt along the length of the metal flue pipe. He located the draftostat with its small, round, swinging door, shoved his t-shirt into the flue, and plugged it. By morning, they would all be asleep for good. Quickly, Mitty moved back to the washtub, his socks silent on the cement. He turned on the faucet again so they'd place him on that side of the room. He kept expecting them to pulverize him, but they didn't come after him. Maybe they still believed they wouldn't get smallpox if they just didn't touch him. Maybe they were afraid of spiders. Who knew? Mitty prayed silently, but the wrong prayers came out. He bargained with God. "Let me live and I'll be smart, hardworking, useful, and generous. Is it a deal? I'll be the best student in the whole world, the best son, the best everything." The Blakes went to church maybe 4 or 5 Sundays a year. Mitty remembered a lot of those Sundays individually. Different churches, different ministers, different states. But Mitty always felt the same, equal parts insider and outsider. "Don't go begging God for help in tight spots," one minister had said, "when you didn't bother to thank him for the good ones." Mitty suddenly knew he was an insider after all. "I didn't bother," Mitty said to God. "But luckily it's you, and you always bother. So here I am, and I'll see you around pretty soon." Time moved slowly. Every now and then the phone in the kitchen rang. The guys had gotten cold. Mitty was used to it down here, but they weren't. They moved the bed next to the furnace. By the burner light, Mitty could see them in a ghostly sort of way. They didn't lie down, but sat with their backs together, propping each other up, nice and close to the source of carbon monoxide. One of the terrorists had a wristwatch that lit up when he pressed the little knob on the side. He lit it constantly. Mitty checked his own watch. Saturday night, February 14. The outer edge of the catch smallpox or not schedule. He stroked his skin. But since the first visible symptoms were not raised, he wouldn't ever know. On the other hand, if carbon monoxide got him first, his complexion would be turning cherry red, the outward sign of that kind of poisoning. He felt awful. He was going to fade before they did. It would be so lame if they got through this and he didn't. If only he could be alive to make sure his plan worked. Mitty needed to rest his head on something. Paper rustled as the men turned to watch him, but they didn't get off the mattress. Mitty curled up at the base of the stairs, with the bottom step supporting the weight of his head. He felt marginally less terrible. He had not done much to save New York, but he had done something. He thought of Olivia. This wasn't the Valentine's Day she had wanted. He made his apologies to his parents. "You gave me good genes and good rules and good love. I'm sorry this is going to be lousy for you." To God he gave thanks. "You gave me great parents and a great life, but I shrugged. Thank you for letting me have a few days when I didn't shrug." Mitty's eyes closed. He slumped down. After a while, his head rolled onto the floor, and his body blocked the stairs. Chapter 18. The sun was going down on Valentine's Day. As they had on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, Derek and Olivia were walking in Riverside Park. They were going uptown, with the Hudson River on their left, and the strip of trees, and tennis courts, and pretty little stone buildings on their right. It was getting cold and dark, but the sidewalk was still a promenade for lovers. There were old couples, and young couples, scary couples, and sweet couples. Olivia and Mitty had stood on the edge of being a couple, but they hadn't quite become one. Olivia stared at the river. She could not imagine the actual act of stepping off this sidewalk and into that water. "We're never going to know," she thought. "He vanished, and we won't ever find out where he went, or if somebody took him and what they did." How absurd Derek and I were to think we could print out his smallpox paper and come up with some knowledge that would guide us to a rescue plan. Of course we didn't learn a thing, except that Mitty did fine research without me, and that smallpox is quite literally the last thing you want on Earth. The FBI and the CDC were in touch constantly with Mr. and Mrs. Blake, who were in touch constantly with Derek and Olivia. But if they had found out anything or gotten anywhere, they did not tell the Blakes. Everybody was too slow, thought Olivia. Mitty was gone a dozen hours before the search really began. Any scene on a sidewalk, any witness to an event, any clue dropped in the street was already forgotten. Solving a crime is impossible for slow people. It's probably impossible for fast people who get there late. Ahead of them was a couple, half dancing along as they held hands and leaned on each other with affection. Tied to the woman's wrist was a balloon bouquet, and clasped in the man's other hand was their dog's leash. The dog was mutt shape and color, small, ratty, and desert yellow. But the couple loved their dog. Olivia could tell because of the crisp Valentine's scarf tied so jauntily around its neck. The couple turned around and were now face to face with Olivia and Derek. They were old, wrinkled and gray, and giggling with love. "Oh, Mitty," thought Olivia, "I want you to grow old. Don't die young." "Remember the anti-war poem we read for Mrs. Abrams?" asked Derek. "By Wilfred Owen?" In English, Mrs. Abrams skipped around. You'd be doing 10th century stuff followed by 19th century stuff, whip back to the 16th and circle around to the early 20th. Mrs. Abrams loved World War I literature. "Don't tell your children the old lie. Dulce et decorum est pro patria mori," wrote Wilfred Owen. "That it is sweet and wonderful to die for your country. Because it isn't. Dying for your country means choking on poison gas and rotting in a trench." "Mitty didn't think it was an old lie," said Derek. "He thought it was an old truth. It is pleasing and proper to die for your country. He respected people who died for their country. Mitty wasn't a pacifist. He said, our teachers want us to roll over and play dead. But he would go bear hunting with a stick before he let anybody get away with stuff against his city. The previous fall, Olivia had not had a crush on Mitty, and since they were in different sections for English, she had not read his essay. She remembered her own, in which she mocked people who died for their country, called them suckers. "Mitty loved heroes," said Derek. What is a hero had been their next essay topic. Mitty said that a hero, Derek told her, is the guy who runs into the burning building to save the baby.
It's an okay definition if you save the baby, said Olivia. But what if you see the burning building and hear the baby crying and run as fast as you can, but you're not fast enough, and you can't get through the flames?
You could die trying, and that would count.
You can't be a hero unless people know, said Olivia.
He'd know, said Derek. I think that would be enough for Mitty. Chapter 19. Mitty could no longer move his eyelids or his toes, not his fingers or even his tongue. The end was almost here. He heard voices shouting, feet smashing on the stair treads. He felt himself turned over, patted, examined. "Not enough light," said someone clearly. Mitty was hoisted into the air and carried like the sack of limp flesh that he was. The person going up first held Mitty around the chest and under the arms, and that person was strong. The person holding Mitty's feet was not strong and let his heels catch on the steps. He was dropped. His skull clunked against the floor. He managed to open his eyes. His cheek was pressed on old speckled linoleum. The door to the outside had been left open. Icy wind filled the kitchen above his prison. Air. Blessed air. But oxygen did not bring strength. Mitty could not lift his head or even pull his hands from under his twisted body. A car had been backed up to that kitchen door. All its doors had also been left open. Ready, Mitty supposed, for everybody to leap in and drive on to their next destination. A destination, presumably, that Mitty would not like any better than this one. He had thought that, like the passengers in the plane over Pennsylvania, he could bring down the murderers with their own weapon. Well, he couldn't. The people hovering over him now were dressed in street clothes. He knew the woman in brown by her boots, but she was not the one who spoke. Since Mitty could not lift his head, the other person knelt beside him. Gloved hands patted Mitty's face, and gloved hands pressed upward on his eyelids, forcing them open. From behind a mask, this time a surgical mask, white and clean, a man said, "So, you have it, the smallpox." "Should have done your research," thought Mitty. "I am impressed that you overcame your guards. But your victory lasts only a minute. You will kill your own people for us, and we will dance in your streets." He stood up. He was laughing. The woman in brown and the man in the mask went back down into the cellar to get the guards. "No," thought Mitty Blake. "You will not dance in my streets." Mitty Blake rolled over. He kicked the cellar door shut. The recorded low temperature on the night of February 14 and the dawn of February 15 in New York City was 15 degrees. The boy with no shirt on slept by an open door, the poison seeping out of his body. His 9/11 call took place on Sunday, February 15 at 2:22 p.m. Later, it was announced that the accidental deaths of four illegal aliens from carbon monoxide poisoning were due to a malfunctioning furnace. Two laptops and three cellular phones were confiscated by the NYPD. Work began to find a money trail, a paper trail, and links to terrorist groups. Fearing a general panic, the authorities did not publicize a terrorist attempt to acquire smallpox. The CDC made changes to their website, stating clearly and frequently that it was not possible to become infected with smallpox from old smallpox scabs, and that if such a scab were found, viable virus could not be recovered from that scab. Mitty Blake did not get smallpox. His injuries did, however, require a hospital stay. Not many people received permission to visit. The few people who did visit were shaken to find guards at the door of Mitty's room, to find themselves asked to produce identification, and to have the contents of their bags examined. His parents told most people, classmates and neighbors and friends from the building and friends from the gym and friends from who know where, that Mitty had been in a car accident, but he would be fine. Right now he needed quiet. Mitty personally hated quiet and was glad to have the FBI and the NYPD and his parents and his sister around debriefing him. Everybody wanted every detail. There were some details Mitty did not plan to share. He was pretty sure his father knew this, and pretty sure his mother never suspected. Emily had flown home from college and spent 24 hours a day, since they were all three sleepless with fear, promising their parents that Mitty would be found alive. All she said now was, "Mitty, Blake, how could you make that many stupid decisions all in a row?" His parents took turns sleeping in the chair next to Mitty's bed, and only when his sister or the FBI intervened would his mom and dad actually leave the room. Even then, his mother grilled the guard to make sure Mitty would be protected in her absence. On the third day, Derek and Olivia were allowed in. Since Mitty's mother and father and sister and the guard and a stray CDC official were there too, greetings were stilted and conversation was awkward. Finally, Emily took control and herded everybody out. When the door shut behind them, Derek came right to the point. "So are you brain damaged? I read up on carbon monoxide poisoning. Are you functioning or are you a vegetable?" "I am functioning at such a high level," said Mitty, hurling his dinner tray at Derek, "that you will never attain it." Derek caught the tray like a frisbee, slung it back, and then whipped Mitty with a thermal blanket, accidentally scattering dozens of get-well cards. Mitty reached for a heavy pottery vase of flowers. "Stop it, Mitty," commanded Olivia, "or this hospital room is going to look as awful as your bedroom." "You've been in my bedroom?" said Mitty, grinning in spite of his wired jaw. "What have I missed?"
"Me," said Olivia. "You've missed me."
That night, his father helped him get ready for sleep, and his mother actually agreed not to spend the night in the chair, but to go on home and see him in the morning. Mitty knew it took courage for her to walk away. He knew his sister had worked to make it happen. He didn't have to tell Emily that he owed her, and she didn't have to tell him that it was okay. She just said, "I won't see you at breakfast, Mitty. I'm flying back to school." His eyes teared up, one of the many annoyances of being ill. They all hugged, wordlessly exchanging farewells, except for his mother, who was never wordless. And at last, Mitty was alone. Mitty sat up in bed and looked out his window at New York City. He couldn't see much. It was kind of a boring view, actually. It could have been any city. "But it's my city," thought Mitty Blake. "And no bad guys are dancing in my streets."
This has been an Audible Inc. production of Code Orange, written by Carolyn B. Cooney, narrated by Jeremy Beck. Executive producer, Jennifer Bassick. Producer, Mike Jarzik. Production coordinator, Kat Lambricks. Engineered and directed by Josh Barch and Keith Reynolds. Music by Michael Whalen. Copyright 2005 by Carolyn B. Cooney. Production copyright 2009 by Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.